The theme of this event is the politics of diversity. So I thought I'd like to make a contribution to the debate about multiculturalism. As I think you all know, right now in Britain there's a big reassessment going on about the pros and cons of multiculturalism. Is it a good thing or is it not? What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? And there have been some quite high-profile attacks on the concept of multiculturalism from some very prominent political figures. Even someone like Trevor Phillips, the black head of the new Commission for Equality and Human Rights, has cast doubt on the value of the multicultural ethos. So I want to really address and explore some of those issues and then open up to a debate where we can perhaps reflect on the positives and the negatives of multiculturalism as it is. I think my starting point is that in the context of the debate about multiculturalism, very large sections of liberal and left opinion in this country seem to have rowed back on their commitment to the principle of universal human rights. You know, the idea that we are all equal with equal rights and responsibilities is now much more ambiguous, much more uncertain, much more qualified by some people on the left of politics. And I think we see that in the way in which race and religion have become the leading, predominant foci of debates around multiculturalism, to the exclusion of other diversities. I think it's undoubtedly true that we have what I would call a hierarchy of oppression in this country, where some minority communities are more valued than others, where some forms of oppression are deemed more reprehensible than others, where some communities have greater legal rights and protections than others. And I think we have often seen in this debate and in this hierarchy of oppression the way in which the rights of women and gay people in particular have been often sidelined and downgraded in deference to the rights of racial and religious minorities. And we often hear people say that we need to show respect for diversity. We need to show cultural sensitivity when we're discussing the rights of women, for example. So when we have a debate about the hijab or the veil, you know, we often hear people on the left of politics talk in this language of cultural traditions, cultural sensitivity, and so on. Whereas they never would have done so had it been a question about other faiths, i.e. particularly white community faiths, adopting particular norms of behaviour and particular restrictions on women. So, to me, this represents quite a dangerous and depressing trend in what I would call a rather tainted interpretation of left-wing and progressive politics. In our society, we are, at least in theory, all supposed to be equal. But in reality, some people in our society are deemed more equal than others. As I said, race and religion invariably trump sexuality and gender. And we see this in legislation. We see it in the interpretation and enforcement of legislation. And I'll come on to that a little bit later. But I think we need to face up to the fact that not only do we have differential laws concerning equality and human rights, which treat different sections of society differently, but also, even when the laws are equal, they are interpreted and enforced differentially. A good example of this is the way in which a number of Jamaican reggae and dancehall singers openly put out records advocating the murder of lesbian and gay people. These aren't homophobic lyrics. These are lyrics that incite the killing of other human beings because of their sexual orientation. And they are allowed to put out those records. They're allowed to sell them. Radio stations are allowed to play them. Record stores are allowed to disperse them. When we all know that if a white racist singer was advocating the killing of black people, or Jewish people, or Muslims, they would be arrested, prosecuted, and probably jailed. So I ask you, why is there a differential enforcement of the law against incitement to murder? Likewise, we see, again, a minority, but some Muslim clerics openly say that women who have sex outside of marriage should be put to death, should be killed. And in this country, in Britain, in the 21st century, women are murdered in so-called honour killings. Only a small number, but women, Muslim women, who marry or seek to marry the wrong kind of man, are in some sections of the Muslim community at risk of threats, violence, abuse, and even murder. The police know of at least a dozen women who've been murdered in these so-called honour killings in the last few years. And I suspect that is just the tip of the iceberg. So I ask myself, how do we get in this awful moral mess where we don't have equal laws and we don't have equal interpretation and enforcement of the laws that exist? Well, I think that the advent of multiculturalism, or more particularly, the way multiculturalism has sometimes been interpreted, is part of the problem. It's not the whole problem. You know, I don't agree with those on the political right who say that multiculturalism was bad ipso facto. I don't believe in those who want to ditch it completely. But I think we have to face up to the fact that certain interpretations of multiculturalism have paved the way for this differential interpretation, enforcement, and legislation of law. Let me be really, really clear. In my view, multiculturalism has, on the whole, been a very positive, laudable social advance. To me, it's a major evolution in our society and our culture. A positive one. One that's brought great, great benefits. I think it's undoubtedly true that it's good to recognize, celebrate, and respect different cultures and people. You know, one of the great things about living in this country, particularly in the major cities, is the huge diversity of people from different cultures, nations, races, languages, religions, abilities, sexualities, and so on. Those diversities are a great strength which make for a very exciting and vibrant society. And as someone who grew up in the 1950s, I think, you know, boy, what a pleasant, positive change from the monoculturalism of that era, when there was just a very narrow, singular cultural entity in this country and indeed in most other Western countries. You know, in those days, there was a prescriptive, normative view of culture, of tradition, of laws, of values, of institutions. There was a sameness, a boringness, a homogeneity which was exclusive, which marginalized people who were different, which didn't accept and celebrate diversity. And just to give you, you know, two examples from my own memory, you know, we just think of the monoculturalism in the United States in the 1950s, which was about a predominantly Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, white culture, which enforced laws of racial segregation and the denial of voting rights. You know, just over half a century ago, black people in large parts of America could not vote or had great obstacles placed in their way if they wished to vote. You know, going to a restaurant or a cafe or a bar or a beach was all segregated in large parts of the southern United States. That was just half a century ago. In this country, in the 1950s, of course, male homosexuality was totally illegal, and in those days still punishable by a maximum penalty of life imprisonment for consenting adult same-sex relations. So what I'm trying to say is that the old pattern of monoculturalism was very oppressive to many, many people. It excluded lots of people from the opportunities, the choices, the legal rights and entitlements that the majority culture took for granted. So I guess in that sense, multicultural diversity has been a liberating and uplifting force for millions of hitherto marginalized people. You know, for women, for disabled, black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and many others. I think the right to be different ethos of multiculturalism gave these marginalized, excluded social groups a dignity, a value, and a space in the public sphere that they never had before. And that all those things are good. It's good that at last difference and the right to be different is accepted, celebrated, and affirmed. So those are the positive sides, you know, the liberating, beneficial aspects of multiculturalism. What about the downside? I think that even though it may have never been intended, one of the negative aspects or growths out of multiculturalism has been a tendency to divide people, to divide them on racial, religious, and other grounds. Asserting and defending the right to be different is a good thing, but it can also lead to separation, ghettoization, and a non-mixing of different communities. So in those circumstances, sometimes perhaps it can spill over into rivalries and antagonisms. You know, where I live in Southeast London, we have a serious problem about racial antagonisms, not between black and white, but between Afro-Caribbean and Asian youths. There's a real problem because the cultural differences are deemed by their communities to be irreconcilable. And we have quite serious, large-scale gang fights in my neighborhood between Asian and Afro-Caribbean youths. We also see in parts of the country, you know, rivalries and antagonisms between Asians who are Muslim and Asians who are Hindu. There's been a recent report about a minority of Muslims who are trying to encourage forced conversions among Hindu women in particular. You know, that Hindu women are being targeted by some Muslim extremist groups to force or pressure or threaten them into converting to Islam. And I think that these divisions need to be acknowledged. Pretending they're not happening isn't going to get us anywhere. We need to face up to the fact that they are a reality, and we need to find ways of overcoming them. Because when we have a division so extreme, when difference becomes celebrated at the exclusion of our common humanity, then notions of universal human rights and freedoms get undermined. I think what we're seeing in parts of our society, and it's only parts, but we are seeing sort of new forms of tribalism, where society is fragmented into myriad communities, each loyal primarily to themselves and with little interest, apparently, in the common good of society. And that, to me, is a dangerous trend. It's a very negative trend. Because at the end of the day, I want to celebrate and affirm difference and defend the right of people to be different, but I also want us to recognise our common humanity, our common interest in working together to tackle the common problems we all face. To give you another example, in the 1980s, in response to racism and police harassment, all non-white people united together in this country under the banner of black. Black embraced Afro-Caribbean, African, Asian, and so on. They were all united as non-white people determined to challenge racism, determined to ensure fair shares for the racial and ethnic minorities of this country. But then something happened. Black divided into black and Asian. So it was a split between Afro-Caribbean and African activists and those from the Asian community. Now, more recently, what we've seen is that there's a split within the Asian community, where part of the Asian community is broken off to identify primarily as Muslim, apparently rejecting alliances with Hindus, Sikhs, and Buddhists, with other Asians who have a different faith. And what I find very disturbing is that sections of the left have gone along with this fragmentation, actually encouraged it. If you read any of the newspapers of the far left groups who make a great, great thing about defending Muslim people against oppression, an argument I entirely endorse, but what you don't hear from them is any defense of Hindus or Sikhs or Buddhists. They seem to have aligned themselves with one religious community within the wider Asian community. Yet all sections of the Asian community, to varying degrees and in various different geographies, experience social exclusion, deprivation, and disadvantage. And I think this trend to divide communities on religious lines is extremely damaging and dangerous. But you will very rarely find anybody prepared to say that. Very rarely will anybody actually say, this is a bad way to do politics. You know, what we're seeing now is the importation into Britain of the communalism on religious lines which has plagued and damaged the Indian subcontinent. Do we want that? I don't. I look back to the days of the Asian youth movements of the 1980s, where all Asian people from all different national and religious backgrounds worked together. I look back to the days of the Indian Workers Association, which fought many heroic strikes on behalf of Asian communities who were exploited in sweatshop conditions. But they brought together all people of Indian backgrounds, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, Baha'i, and atheist, all united together, working in one movement to advance their common agenda. And so I find it really, really strange and disturbing that large sections of the left now have got a lot to say, and often quite rightly, about the oppression of Muslim people, but little or nothing to say about the racism experienced by Asians of other faiths or of no faith at all. I suppose, on reflection, I'd say that what we're seeing is a sort of, to use borrow a term from the ex-Yugoslavs, the balkanization of the humanitarian agenda. People are increasingly fragmented according to their different and often competing identities, values and traditions. And these differences seem to get prioritized over shared experiences and interests. So in other words, our common needs and the universality of human rights get pushed to the side in favor of racial and religious particularities. Another interesting thing is the way in which multiculturalism has been interpreted in a very, I think, quite authoritarian way. There are people who adhere to the multicultural agenda who seem to think that, yeah, we accept and affirm difference and the right to be different. Great. But they do so in a way that looks at each minority community as a single homogenous lump or block. They don't acknowledge the differences and diversities within minority cultures. So, for example, you know, you get rather stereotyped and cliched views about the gay community. And you get, you know, governments like the one we have, which deals with one gay rights organization, Stonewall, to the exclusion of all others. It set up Stonewall as the gatekeeper in terms of dealing with lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. To give another example, in the Jewish community, there is a big debate within the Jewish community about the state of Israel and its policy of occupying the Palestinian territories. But you hardly ever see that debate reflected at the upper levels of establishment Jewish organizations like the chief rabbi and his office, like the Board of Deputies of British Jews. There's a rather narrow and rather mono view given out by these organizations about the state of Israel and its policies in Palestine. And of course, that isn't a fair or honest representation of the Jewish community, because there are plenty of Jewish people who dissent from the Orthodoxy, who have a critical view of Israel's policies, who want to see justice for the Palestinian people. But their voices often don't get heard. Because what happens is that, you know, left-wing and progressive organizations, governments, local authorities deal with the official Jewish bodies, like the Board of Deputies for British Jews. So they just get one view, one interpretation of Jewish opinion. You know, the dissidents, if you like, within the Jewish community who have a different view, they don't get invited to Downing Street. They don't get invited to meet the Metropolitan Police. They don't get invited to meet the Foreign Office. What happens is that official bodies deal with the establishment. And of course, we see the same trend in other communities. I mentioned Stonewall, you know, where the government has handpicked Stonewall, one gay rights organization out of 20 or 30 to do business with, to the exclusion of all others. We also see this rather authoritarian strand of multiculturalism at work in the way the Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, has, in the name ostensibly of cultural diversity and defence of Muslim communities, allied only with certain particular Muslim organisations, such as the Muslim Council of Britain and the Muslim Association of Britain. Now, these organisations, they have their place. They do represent strands and fragments of Muslim opinion. They should be heard. But there are also many other Muslim organizations that don't get heard, that don't get invited to City Hall or to Downing Street. And in particular, we find that liberal and progressive Muslims are systematically excluded from government consultation and from left-wing campaigns and activism. And why is that? Why is it that ostensibly liberal progressive movements don't want to deal with liberal progressive Muslims? They'd rather deal with those who believe in Sharia law or who support Hezbollah or the Iranian regime. Now, I'm personal friends with one of the most esteemed Islamic theologians in this country. He's a personal friend of mine. I can't name him because I'm afraid, and he's afraid, of the repercussions. But he says, according to his understanding of Islam, that women should have full equality. That the idea that women should be veiled and subservient to men is based on an erroneous interpretation of the Quran. Now, he never gets invited to Downing Street. He never gets invited by Ken Livingstone and given a platform at City Hall. Why not? You know, many others are in the same situation. The late Zaki Badawi, another very esteemed Muslim leader in this country, was again sidelined by much of the establishment in this country because he preached a liberal, progressive Islam that conflicted with the conservative right-wing orthodoxy of groups like the Muslim Association of Britain and the Muslim Council of Britain. On a sort of vaguely similar line, I suppose another disturbing development is the tendency for multiculturalism to be cited as a justification for tolerating beliefs and behaviours that conflict with liberal humanitarian values, such as the veiling of young girls in many Islamic societies. Now, my own view is, if a woman, an adult woman, wishes to wear a veil, that's her right and her choice. Just the same as, you know, a young man can wear a baseball hat back to front and wear baggy jeans. That's a choice, a fashion choice, you know, fine. What I don't like, though, is the idea that women, Muslim women in this country and in most of the Islamic world, are pressured, in effect forced to wear the veil because of expectations and traditions from their families, their neighbours, the imams, the wider community. You know, we just, in the last 2 days, seen the mass arrest of women in Iran because they were deemed to dress immodestly. They'd worn the veil on the back of their head and not right down the front. Hundreds have been arrested and carted off to prison. I don't think we can say we have to respect that cultural tradition. I don't think we should say, well, that's their religion or that's their culture or that's their history. I think we need to say that human rights are universal and indivisible, and that every woman on this planet is entitled to respect, dignity and rights, is entitled to autonomy and choice, not to be pressured to behave in certain ways, or to dress in certain ways, or to speak in certain ways. You know, there are, of course, many people in the Muslim community who point out that there is no requirement in the Quran for a woman to be veiled. No requirement whatsoever. This is a cultural practice that has been imposed on Islam centuries ago by reactionaries and anti-progressives who sought to turn what is, in essence, in many ways, you know, a quite liberal and progressive, or large elements of progressiveness within it, turn it into a religion of control, a religion of authoritarianism. And I just think we need to say very clearly, without disrespecting Muslim people, but we need to say very clearly that women in all societies and all cultures deserve dignity, rights and respect. And that to require women or to pressure them to wear the veil when they don't want to, that is wrong. And of course, anybody who knows anything about the Islam religion knows that that position is perfectly consistent. You know, in Islam, one of the key principles is that there should be no compulsion in religion. It says that in the Quran. people should have a choice. You know? And so giving women a choice about their way they dress is entirely right. And I said, that to me is a good example of how the right to be different is or can be abused. I grew up in an era when the right to be different was an important principle, and when the left also stood in solidarity with all people suffering oppression. The race or religion of the victims and the perpetrators didn't matter. We weren't interested in whether oppression was religiously motivated or politically motivated or ethnically motivated. We were just concerned to help and support those who were suffering, to challenge those who were perpetrating tyranny. But I think we have seen, not all, but some sections of the left drift away from that universal principle in the last two or three decades. What I call moral and cultural relativism is gaining ground. We're told time and time again that every community is different, with different values, different histories, different traditions, different ways of dealing with issues. So, for example, in the last two or three years, when myself and many others have been campaigning against the Jamaican reggae and dancehall singers who put out these tracks advocating killing gays and lesbians, we are often told by people on the left that homophobia is part of Jamaican culture and that we shouldn't seek to impose our alien Western values on the people of Jamaica. Well, in fact, of course, regardless of whether or not it's part of Jamaican tradition, homophobia and oppression is wrong, full stop. But even on that point, they're wrong. Because, of course, the anti-gay tradition in Jamaica was imposed on that nation by British colonialism. You know, the British colonial administration were the ones who introduced the anti-gay laws. You know, the 10 years hard labour for male homosexuality in Jamaica today was imposed by the British colonial administration in the 19th century. Before that time, there were no laws in Jamaica against homosexuality. Earlier, of course, you know, Christian missionaries, particularly from Scotland, a very hard-line sort of interpretation of Protestantism, went out to Jamaica and preached hellfire and brimstone and created a whole religious tradition in Jamaica of extreme homophobia. So, on reflection, the origins of the extreme homophobia and homophobic violence you see in Jamaica today actually is a legacy of that colonial era. And I think we need to challenge it. And I don't think that people in Jamaica can, as they sometimes do, claim that this is part of our tradition, that it's our culture. It's not. Homophobia was never part of an authentic Jamaican culture. It was part of a culture imposed on Jamaica by British colonizers and their Christian missionary allies. I remember writing about this for The Guardian, and The Guardian, Britain's main liberal newspaper, gave not one but two writers a platform to attack me as a racist and imperialist. Well, they didn't quite exactly use those words, but that was the subtext of everything they were saying. That's not the way black, lesbian, and gay Jamaicans see it. Our campaign was in solidarity with black, lesbian, and gay Jamaicans who are suffering extreme oppression. You know, just yesterday, a Jamaican man waiting at a bus stop who looked gay was set upon a mob and nearly beaten to death. Nearly beaten to death just because he looked gay. They didn't know he was gay. They assumed he was gay and tried to beat him to death. Well, if that is Jamaican tradition, and as I said, I dispute that it is, it's not a tradition we should be supporting or condoning in any way whatsoever. I think we always have to ask ourselves, if we wouldn't accept something in our society, why should we accept it in another society? If we wouldn't accept large-scale violence and even murder of black people in Britain, why should we tolerate it when it's happening in Zimbabwe or Jamaica or Uganda or wherever? Again, all back to the principle, human rights are universal and indivisible. And I think that the real racism is not campaigning in solidarity with black and other non-white peoples who are fighting oppression. The real racism is the way in which some of the liberal left nowadays look the other way when that violence and oppression is happening. Because they're judging it by different standards. They're looking at it in a way that they would not look at it if it was happening here in Britain. You know, thankfully, most progressive people, when they hear about the death of a black person in police custody, get angry, demand answers, and support campaigns to win justice for the family and community affected. So my view is, why don't they do the same when it comes to black people who are suffering similar oppression in other countries? I think there's also a great timidity about dealing with conflicts within minority communities. I think we're all familiar with the uproar that was created in Birmingham over the Sikh play Betsy. This was a play written by a Sikh woman about oppression and discrimination within the Sikh community, particularly affecting Sikh women. And the Sikh community, or rather sections of the Sikh community in Birmingham, organized to threaten and intimidate the theatre, the staff, and members of the public who wanted to see the play, and forced its cancellation. Now, I don't want to cause insult or offence to the Sikh community. I want to respect, embrace, and value them as part of our society. But I don't think that can include intimidation to the point where a play has to be cancelled because of threats or violence. That is a denial of free speech. You can't have a free society when writers live in fear of being killed. I mean, you know, you may not agree with Salman Rushdie. You may not think Satanic Verses was a very good book. But in a free and open society, he should have had the right to have that book published and not to be looking over his shoulder in fear of being killed. The same goes for the many other dissident writers around the world. You know, every year, writers and journalists are murdered for simply writing words. Words which challenge orthodoxy and authority. I think we need to say very clearly that a free society means sometimes putting up with things that you find unpalatable. When Sir Iqbal Sukrani, then General Secretary of the Muslim Council of Britain, denounced gay people as diseased, immoral, and harmful, I found it extremely offensive. I think most people who weren't even gay found it incredibly offensive. But I didn't support him being prosecuted. You know, and when the police did investigate him, I spoke out and said this was wrong. What he said was offensive, insulting, inaccurate, but it should not be the subject of criminal law and sanctions. Now, agreeing with someone is one thing, disagreeing is another. We have to find a way to have a public debate, to work out our differences, which doesn't involve threats, intimidation, and violence, where people aren't afraid to speak out, where the Islamic theologian I mentioned earlier would be quite happy and comfortable with me mentioning his name, and where he would get a platform and his views would be published and he wouldn't have to fear being killed. Being killed in this country in 2007. That's the fear he's under, which is why I cannot mention his name. But finally, I just want to conclude by saying that all people possess a culture. But this does not mean that all cultures are equally virtuous. You don't often get someone who says that. We're supposed to say that all cultures are equal and all cultures are just as good as the other. I've got to say, hand on my heart, no, they're not. You know, there are certain laws, certain political systems, certain technologies that are inferior. The same goes for values. Some values and ideas are better than others. And we shouldn't be afraid to say it. The Enlightenment was better than the Dark Ages. Freedom is better than slavery. Democracy is better than fascism. Scientific knowledge is superior to superstition. And, dare I say it, future civilizations will undoubtedly be much better than our own. I think what we sometimes lack is a sense of ethics and morality. There's a fear, because of the way moralism has been used and manipulated to oppress, people nowadays are very afraid of saying that some things are right and some things are wrong, that some values are better than others. I think we have to recapture that, not in order to dictate or punish or to to promote a supremacism, but in order to assert and defend basic fundamental humanitarian values. In my view, all human beings deserve respect, but not all beliefs and traditions should be respected. Your political and religious ideas based on racism, patriarchy, and homophobia are unworthy. They don't deserve respect. They need to be challenged, not tolerated, and certainly not indulged in the name of respect for other cultures. So on that point, I'd round off by saying that multiculturalism is something worth defending. It has been a great advance in human and social evolution. The right to be different, plurality and diversity, these are all positive values, positive experiences. But we have to, at the same time, be really clear that there are certain red lines over which that must not stray. Namely, the right to be different is a fundamental human right, but not if it involves the oppression and harm of other human beings. Thank you.